Esther chapter 3. Keeping in mind now that the book of Esther is one major single crisis, and the first chapters anticipate that crisis, and they bring in the steps, the chapters, the elements, the events that lead us up into that. The first one was the dethronement of Vashti, chapter 1. Second was the enthronement of Esther, chapter 2, down through verse 20. And now we're ready for the other element that needs to come in, and that is the loyalty of Mordecai. We've had, first of all, to the king. A plot against the king's life is made. He reports it. And we said, when that happens, two things you need to really log in your mentality. When they wrote down that Mordecai had told the court officials of the impending plot, writing it down was strictly routine. And second, the oversight was Mordecai got no reward. And that is very unusual. So keep in your mentality, routine matter, wrote the report of the assassination down. Number two, he was given nothing. He was honored no way. Unusual oversight. And we'll want to have those back in our mentality because they will be used by God in His providence to overrule this coming crisis, which will be, namely, the annihilation of the entire Jewish race and how God in chapter 6 will overrule the whole thing. We're down now to his loyalty to God, chapter 3. Haman is promoted. And we have chapter 3 beginning this way. After these events. Now, whenever in Esther you see something like after these events, remember this. When you begin in chapter 1 and end up in chapter 10, you have covered 10 to 12 years of time. And so we don't want to read this as though Monday morning this happened, Monday at 10 o'clock this happened, then at noon this happened, then at 3 in the afternoon this happened, everybody went to bed at 9 o'clock that night, the king could not sleep, he got up the next morning, the crisis was there, and by 3 o'clock in the afternoon it was all over. Not at all. 10 years at least from the time the queen Vashti is deposed up until the salvation and the delivery of God's people. So we're looking at God's providence over a long period of time. And therefore, when you come to chapter 3 after these events, this could be, and probably is, many, many years. As a matter of fact, we can somewhat focus on that. Look at 2:16. Because in 2:16, we are told exactly the year in which Vashti, or rather Esther, became queen. Chapter 2, verse 16. So Esther was taken to King Xerxes to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now, pass through those years and come now down to chapter 3 and verse 7. In the first month, which is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Xerxes. So notice between 2:16 and 3:7, you've got a period of some 4 or 5 years. So when we begin chapter 3 then, after these events, probably by as much as 4 or 5 years later, King Xerxes promoted Haman. And our first question ought to be, obviously, who is Haman? Who is Haman? Now, we know several things about him. Number one, we know he's going to be a Jew hater. We know that he is going to be the one that says, I want every Jew in the whole kingdom killed. We want to annihilate all of them. So he will be a very vicious man. But asking, first of all, who is Haman? And notice in number one, he was a descendant of Agag. He was a descendant of a king whose name was Agag. As we have said so many times, if you read the Bible at all and you have a baby, you should have no problem coming up with some wonderful names. There's a nice little boy's name. This is little Agag. Somehow these names never appeal to anybody, do they? I don't like them very well, but there's a possibility. Now, who was he? 1 Samuel 15. 1 Samuel 15, we find out who he was, or who Agag was. Remember the three girls that had the dispute in the book of Joshua over their portion of the land? One of the girls' name was Hogla. There's another possibility. Hogla, H-O-G-L-A-H. This is my daughter, Hogla. It's a guarantee she will not marry till late in life. Good technique there. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 1. Then Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you as king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for all that he for what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming up from Egypt. Now, catch this, go and strike Amalek, utterly destroy all that he has. Do not spare him." Catch that, please. Do not spare him. "But put to death both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." Well, as we proceed and move down to verse 9, Saul does a fairly good job, but he spares Agag. Verse 7. So Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as you go to Shur, which is east of Egypt, and he captured Agag. This is the great, 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 great granddaddy of Haman that we're meeting in Esther. And he captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag. Compare that, again, at least mentally, to the words that were given back in the early part of the chapter, where he was told, do not spare him. And you come down to verse 9, Saul and the people spared Agag, exactly what they were not supposed to do. The best of the oxen, sheep, fatlings, lambs, all that was good, were not willing to destroy them utterly, and so forth. And as you know, coming down to the end of the chapter, that was so serious that God said, because you didn't do that, Saul, you're king no longer. And he was removed from office. So, the first thing we can say then is, who is Haman? A descendant of King Agag. And number two, he is a man who should not be here. He is a man who should not be here. Coming off of 1 Samuel chapter 15. Many, many lessons involved in that. Notice what disobedience does to you. They had some time of peace afterward. But ultimately, it came back and hurt them very, very badly. All right, back to Esther then, chapter 3. Verse 1, after these events, several years, King Xerxes promoted Haman, parenthesis, the man who should not be here. The son of Hammedatha of the Agagite advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down, paid homage to Haman. And we find in the context the refusal on the part of Mordecai. And therefore, question, why did Mordecai not bow? And to that, I think we can give two reasons. Number one, it would have been an affront to God. But number two, it would also have been an affront to his nation. Here are those sent on destroying or bent on destroying Israel. The man should not have been there, and therefore to bow to him would certainly have been an affront. And that leads us to the next event leading up to the crisis, which is the furor of Haman. The furor of Haman. 3:5 through the end of chapter 3, verse 15. And it really takes two aspects to it. Number one is an emphasis on its total irrational character. It made no sense. His fear, his anger was totally irrational in character. Verse 5. Now keep in mind, when we talk about the irrational character of it, that Mordecai was the only Jew who would not bow, and Haman, of all those that bowed, there was only one exception. Now, whenever you have an experience that's bad with one member of a group, what's the human tendency to do when you've been wronged by one member of the group? That guy who jumped in front of me of the parking lot and got my spot was Vietnamese. I hate Vietnamese. They're all pushy. They all do that, right? Well, notice that's the thinking. He had been snubbed. He didn't get his place, and therefore, notice what happens to him in verse 5. When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage, and you think logically it would be rage against Mordecai. No, verse 6. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had been told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought, and note the irrationality of this, to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. Beware of the contagious nature of spite. Rarely does spite center on one person. It is contagious, wildly contagious. And therefore, he is. And notice, by the way, in verse 6, the words, he sought to destroy all the Jews. What was King Saul to do with the Amalekites? He was to destroy all of the Amalekites. And it's kind of an interesting thing, isn't it, that what Saul failed to do to the Amalekites, an Amalekite now proposes to do to the Jews. And so Saul's thinking was all but one in disobedience to God's command, and now it all comes back, and the Amalekites are going to say, not all but one, all Jews. Sort of an ironical twist the thing takes. So it was irrational. However, it did take, number two, a calculated expression. It took a plan. And the calculated expression takes up the rest of the chapter, verses 7 through 11, reading. In the first month, verse 7, which is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of Xerxes, Pur, that is, the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month, until the 12th month, which is the month Adar. The casting of lots at this point was in order to determine what is the most propitious day to kill all the Jews. And I realize we do not think that way in Western thinking, but the thinking of almost all of the Orient was this. The big issue is not, are we going to battle? That's all decided. The big issue is, what is the best day to do it? What is the most propitious day? And therefore, that's where all of your divination came into the picture in the Old Testament. They would look into the calf's liver. They would dissect it. You would have all of your witchcraft, all of your necromancy. All of these things would come in, and it would be all centered in one thing. Is this the day to do it? Sort of a sophisticated farmer's almanac. This is the day to plant onions. And that was their thinking. And thus they cast lots, and the point of casting lots was not, are we going to kill the Jews, but what's the most propitious day? And thus they do that down in verse 7, and that's the stress, and that's the emphasis. What day is going to be the day of slaughter. All of this carried over from astrology, that certain things were more propitiously done on certain days than others. Notice in the context, he approaches the king. Haman, verse 8, said to King Xerxes, he explains this people, they're different, they're Jews. If it's pleasing, verse 9, to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. And then he offers a very handsome sum to get the job done. The king took his signet ring, verse 10, from his hand, gave it to Haman. And when he gave him the signet ring, that was simply saying to him this, you have unlimited authority to carry. It's blank check. Here are a dozen blank checks. Do your job. They're all signed. They're ready to go. Here's my signet ring. Whatever you need to do, do it. Now, what has happened then, Xerxes has been worked in and become a victim of the temper of this man. You see any irony in here? When he gives his signet ring, stamp it, to kill all Jews. Whose death warrant did he just sign? What was his wife's name? Who was the queen? Esther. And thus, when he hands this over to him, this authority, he was literally putting the death sentence on his own queen. And thus, the rest of the chapter, verses 12 through 15, the couriers go out, the message is taken throughout all of the kingdom, everybody gets an account of what is to be done on what day. Verse 13, letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, to annihilate. Remember, we mentioned last week that in the language of the Old Testament, the Hebrew language, they don't use adjectives. They don't say it's a very beautiful flower. They repeat an idea over and over. And notice in verse 13, destroy, say it another way. Kill, say it another way. Annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to seize the possessions as plunder. Now, let's stop and make on this chapter some observations. Observations on Esther, last part of chapter 2 and 3. Mordecai never hesitated about not bowing. And therefore, our first observation, Mordecai honored the Lord and left the consequences to him. Mordecai honored the Lord and left the consequences to him. Unfortunately, Christianity very often is very Pollyannish. That simply means that you honor the Lord, and guess what? Everything will be all right. Your problems will disappear, and life will become one great symphony. Mordecai honored the Lord and left the consequences to him. When he honored the Lord, were the consequences good or bad? Parenthetically, underneath this, things got much, much worse. Things got much worse. There was no thought of killing all the Jews until Mordecai honored God. So we ought to guide ourselves away from the naive idea that if we honor the Lord, things will necessarily get better. There's only one reason for honoring the Lord, and that's this: it's right. And whatever occurs or whatever comes out of it is not really the issue. And therefore, because of his honoring the Lord, the ultimate issue is going to be the destruction of all of the Jews. And therefore, can you imagine the thoughts that would go through Mordecai's mind? I didn't bow. I wonder if I was really right. Now Haman hates me. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. Maybe I've been more conciliatory. Can you imagine what went through his mind when the decree came out? Because this man would not bow. I hate all Jews because I hate all Jews. Haman said we're going to annihilate everyone. When Mordecai had some second thoughts, maybe. I mean, what's a little flex of the knee? Mordecai honored the Lord and left the consequences to him because the issue is that to obey is a matter of right and wrong. It's a matter of what is right. You realize how hard that is to do today? Especially when we live in a country and in a civilization where the big debate is who knows what's right? If you have no moral absolutes, what is right? If we have no moral absolutes, there is no right. And therefore, right is whatever moves you or whatever pleases you or whatever seems to be the present advantage. Mordecai knew it was right, period. And whatever happens as a consequence of that was the issue. And that's why that's why we have organizations like yours today coming along, because moral absolutes have died. I happen to be raised when a generation, and this was not just Christians, but non-Christians alike. Can you go back as far into ancient history as I can? And you thought for sure if anybody had an abortion, the thunder would rattle and they would go to hell, zip. Wasn't that the mentality that was present? But see, it was a mentality that flowed out of a generation and a time in our own country when there are moral absolutes. This is right, and we do it because it is right. We do not do this because it is wrong. Consequences are not the issue. The issue, it is right, and that ought to always be there. And here's a good lesson about that from the book of Esther. Number two. Insignificant things. May become very significant under the providence of God. Insignificant things may become significant under the providence of God. Now, we spent some time last time saying that when Mordecai reported the plot of the court officials to put Xerxes to death, that they wrote it down in the chronicles of the matters of the day, literally. They wrote it down, and we said that was a common thing, that was a usual procedure. And yet he was not rewarded for it, which was highly unusual. And what we will find in Esther 2, verse 23, the last part, where they wrote in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence, a very ordinary event. Routine matter in the fullest sense of the word. However, notice how that insignificance, they did it every day. They always wrote down the history of the day. That was common, that was ordinary, that was every day. But notice how that insignificant thing and the omission of any reward given to Mordecai is become significant when we come to chapter 6. Almost the turning point of the book of Esther. Time has passed. The next day, all the Jews die. The night before, it says, during the night, the king could not sleep. That's insignificant. So he gave an order to bring the book of the records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king, and it was found written what Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthana and Teresh. These are the two guys who were going to kill him. Two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, and they had sought to lay hands on King Xerxes. And the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" Then the king's servants who attended to him said, "Nothing has been done for him." Now, Xerxes, I can't understand why he would get a great deal of pleasure out of saying, "Bring my diary to him to read it." But he goes back several years, reads through it, and notice that will become a highly significant event. Insignificant things, writing something down in a diary, getting to do anything about it, will become very significant under the providence of God and will be very, very, very important. Now, let me put a little note of warning at this point. And I think it's important for Christians that simply this. This does not mean that we are supposed to seek high significance in everything that happens to us. If we would go across the overhead and put an X for each time that the king could not sleep, can we only put one X? Do you think chapter 6 is the only time he could not sleep? Of course it wasn't. You could put X, 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 and the night after, let's suppose the night after he couldn't sleep, what was the significance of the fact that, assuming that to be, that a week later Mordecai or the king could not sleep? What's the significance of that? Nothing. And I think that's important because we will see how significant little events can be. And it's easy to slip into, on the way to church this morning, I had a flat tire. What is God trying to teach you? Pardon my irreverence, but nothing. How are you going to make a big life event out of that? And therefore, be aware of the fact that God, let's suppose, put them across here, X, 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 X. How many flat tires have you had in your lifetime? 7? Of course. How many of them were very significant? How many do you ever recall? Is it possible that God would take this particular one and say, "I circle it. I'm going to do something special with that one," and does it? And the same thing was true with the king. Many times he could not sleep. God circled this one and said, this is going to be special. And therefore, Christians should not be uptight, wringing their hands, trying to interpret every event of life, saying, what is God doing? And I don't mean to be crude, but you burp. Oh, what was God teaching me by that? Probably the significance is nothing more than gastric relief. Nothing spiritual, nothing significant. Could it be? Well, I guess. I don't know how God would use a burp, but if he can use a sleepless night, he could use that too, and he certainly can, and it's within his providence. Be careful about pushing that too hard. Okay, third lesson. Insignificant things may become significant under the providence of God. Third, simple observation off this chapter. Neglected obedience can have long-term impact. Neglected obedience can have long-term impact. And I think you know the passage that I'm referring to. We began chapter 3 with the existence of Haman. Very frankly, Haman, according to 1 Samuel 15, shouldn't have been there. Don't think that neglected obedience, because it does not have payday tomorrow, will never have payday. That's not true. It can have long-term impact, as it does here. Fourth, injustice carries its own sentence with it. Injustice carries its own sentence. Now, where do we get that out of this chapter? Well, I'll simply note Esther 3:13. And Esther 3:13 is the place where the decree goes out that all of the Jews, irrespective of their loyalty to the king, irrespective of their conduct, are going to die. That's unjust. With it, it carried its own sentence, because as Xerxes okays that order, unjust order to kill all Jews, he also signed something else, his queen's death warrant. And it's ironical, is it not, that in the carrying out of injustice, he's going to pay. He doesn't know it, but there is a principle. Unjust conduct carries its own own luggage, and often its own luggage is a very ironical twist, as it is here in this context. Injustice carries its own sentence. Five. Be patient. I only have 300 of these. Number five. And this is coming off of Haman. He got snubbed. He engaged in self-pity. And self-pity was the seedbed of irrational behavior. Self-pity was the seedbed of irrational conduct. That's 3:5. 6. Pride, as it existed in Haman, is never satisfied with anything short of total allegiance. Pride is never satisfied with anything short of total allegiance. Pride can never meet halfway. And we derive this from the fact that Haman was snubbed by one man, and his pride could not be satisfied. It could not be satisfied, because if you cannot give me total allegiance, and by the way, that is always what pride demands. Pride is never satisfied with anything of short of total allegiance. And if every man in the kingdom bows to Haman, Haman is proud, and what is it that galls him and makes him lose sleep at night? That one guy that won't bow. And that's part of the torture that is inevitable with pride. 7. This decree comes out in the law of the Medes and the Persians, which was irrevocable, and it shows this, and will show more so as we go on. The strongest human alliance, the strongest human alliance is no match for the sovereignty of God. Just put short, for God. No way can it be matched. Now let's turn and just get a little start then into chapter 4, and I'll basically show how it's the next step and what was involved in it. So we're going now simply for content of chapter 4, and we'll draw some conclusions tonight. We're at the fifth aspect building up to the crisis to destroy the Jews. The decree to destroy them is now out, and now we have in chapter 4 the plan to save the Jews. 4:1-17. And everything in Esther chapter 4 can really be put under four headings. And each one of them will run this way. Mordecai hears the announcement that the Jews are going to be annihilated. And his thought is this: Esther can help. And he will make three endeavors in this chapter to enlist the help of Esther. And I will summarize each one of them as we're doing an overview right now to close out three words. Number one, connection. First word, connection. 4:1-5. And the thought of Mordecai is this: how can I establish a connection with Esther? You say, well, go up and pound on the door of the palace and say, may I see the queen? No, you didn't do that. Because as chapter 4 begins, he is in sackcloth and ashes. And if you knew the queen was in the palace, how would you get her attention? Make noise. Isn't that what he does in chapter 4, verse 1? When Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, went out into the midst of the city and wailed loudly and bitterly. And then he went as far as the king's gate, for no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And he repeated this. What was he trying to do? Is there any way I can get the attention of Queen Esther? And so 4:1-5, we'll see what he goes through, what he does in order to make noise and get her attention. As soon as he makes contact, the next block is her objection. Connection, objection. And the objection is in 4:6-11. Reading particular verse 11, here's the objection. And here's why she says, we can't do it. She says, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king in the inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so he may live. And I have not been summoned to come into the king for 30 days. So what you saying? Mordecai, you want me to go to the king? Fat chance. Hadn't been called in for a month anyway. What makes you think it's going to be success? I object. And that leads to the third attempt on the part of Mordecai, and to which she responds with resignation. 4:12-17. Notice particularly verse 16. She agrees, she'll give it a shot. Go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa. Fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens will fast in the same way, and thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law. And you see why I use the word resignation? If I perish, I perish. Before she made that move, think of four things that had to go through her mind. Number one, I've got to go into the presence of the king without being summoned. The law, death. That's point number one. That ought to be, you would think, enough to say, I will not go. But second, when she goes in, she is going to request something that can't be granted. the law of the Medes and the Persians was irrevocable. And the edict of the law and the Persians said we're to annihilate all Jews. That's it. What would go through your mind? If I go in, unsummoned, one law, death. Number two, if I go in, I'm going to ask for the release of the Jews, and that cannot be done. Third, what else she would have to do when she went in that she hadn't done before? The king didn't know his wife was a Jewess. So she now has to go in and say, Xerxes, I'm Jewish. Third, she is going to place herself in opposition to the most powerful man in the empire, Haman. Would you go? Well, she does, and we will find wonderful results coming out of it. But that's where we'll be going in our next study through chapter 4. And then at the end of that chapter, we'll make some observations, as we've done at the end of each. And now, Father, we're thankful for your word. We're thankful for your care, your providence, your sovereignty. We're thankful that in spite of the sinfulness of man, that you are not a God to be pushed from the throne. We may forget you, we may disobey you, we may ignore you, but you are forever the God who is always there. And we pray that through the study of this book, we will learn that God cannot be pushed from the pages of history. He cannot be pushed from his throne. He is almighty, he is powerful, he is sovereign. And therefore, may we learn that the only wise course of action ever is to line our will and our thoughts and our actions with the will of God that is revealed in the Scriptures. In Christ's name.